Muller House Meeting, Thursday, 21st September, 1978. The spiritual influence of Johannes Muller, a man of vision and deep insight, permeates Elmau, this valley of peace and inspiration and beauty, because in his life's development that great mystery, a change of consciousness, took place. Let us therefore silently pay homage to his living influence and offer grateful thanks to his person, for he was the source of this living influence. Ancestor worship is not a foolish superstition, provided it is worship in the real sense. For worship means worthship, worthiness, which we reverence and admire. We ourselves today are the expressions of the present living influences which emanated from past persons. In that sense, the past is not dead, but wholly alive in us, in the process of its transformations through time, from their own day to ours. The forms of the past, of course, are dead. The forms as they existed in those days. But the form which is present now, ourselves and the whole world, are the transformations of those forces which they generated. And that's why the whole of the past, insofar as it exerted a living influence, is living now in us. And remember, it's the total past which is living in us in the present moment. It is only the present moment which is the living moment. As soon as the present moment gives place to the next moment, this moment belongs to the past. And in that sense, as far as the present shape is concerned, it is dead. But the transformed influence which the next moment holds because of this moment is living. So in that sense, there is no death at all. There is only transformation and regeneration. Change, which is growth. And this is the important thing we must bear in mind. So, let us also offer our grateful thanks to his children and his families, and their families, who live and work here, carrying on to the best of their ability, the living influence which has descended to us here from the past. And it is by their kind and gracious cooperation that we are privileged to hold our autumn school in Johannes Muller's very own study. This is a great privilege, and I always feel very highly honored to be allowed to speak here. I have just talked about consciousness and its changes. Let us first regard these changes as a series of deaths. How can change take place in any one thing or person unless there is a process of transformation of that thing or person? If we cling to the old form and one want it to continue just as it is, then of course that form dies. But if we don't cling to our desire to perpetuate a past form, we see real growth and development. So it is our attitude to death which makes us understand life itself. And that is why I always call death other life. It is not death in the sense of annihilation. It is death which is the great portal through which one passes from moment to moment in one's life as one transforms. Now, whether that transformation will be a movement forwards to the fulfillment of our divine destiny, or will be a step which is a retrograde step, is our personal responsibility. Now, to come to this word consciousness, the great spiritual teachers in some parts of the world identified the primordial creative energy which brings forth the entire universe through time, but itself acting in eternity. That primordial creative energy is identified with absolute consciousness. So that the word consciousness will not be restricted to something purely mental or purely immaterial. It will, in fact, because it is identified with primordial creative energy which brings forth everything, the known and the unknown, it will also include in itself the totality. It's rather important to bear this in mind, because our process of change of consciousness has as its ultimate fruition the flowering out into pure consciousness, what we commonly call the divine consciousness, the consciousness of God, if you like to use that word, or Brahman, or Atma. or if you like, as the Buddha put it, the unborn, the unmade, the unbecome, which is unimaginable, unthinkable, indescribable. Or if you like, as the philosophers would say, the absolute, or the first cause or prime mover, as Aristotle said, or as Hamilton, an English philosopher, said, the unconditioned. Now, let us bear this clearly in mind. The idea of absolute consciousness being identical with this primordial creative energy. Now, the remarkable thing about primordial creative energy is that it works in absolute freedom. This free activity of the creative energy has no such thing as cause and effect, space, time, substance, and so on, with which our minds are acquainted. It is utterly free. It is acausal, if you like, which includes cause as well as causelessness. These are perhaps difficult to conceive, in fact, very difficult. But if we just let our minds be quiet and let the words act as a stimulus which germinates and makes grow the seed of divine consciousness in ourselves, then we will understand it with a divine understanding which goes beyond all concepts and words. And that is the supreme field and context of religion. Religion not merely as a system of thought and dogma and belief, but religion as that way of life which leads each and every one of us to our own unique, specific fruition. And that is the miracle and the marvel of the whole thing. So now, this primordial creative energy functions in absolute freedom. Therefore, we can say pure consciousness is absolute freedom also, and works in those terms. That pure consciousness, eternally creative, absolutely free, is the source as well as the goal of the whole cosmos. For us, the source means a starting point, a beginning, and the goal means the end point, the end. And we always tend in our minds to separate the two, simply because we function in terms of what is finite, what is limited, what begins and dies, and therefore belongs to the realm of mortality. But pure consciousness, primordial creative energy, is not in our context of mortality. It belongs to the realm of the infinite, the beginningless, the endless, the eternal, the immortal. Therefore, none of our criteria, our standards of judgment, our modes of thinking can possibly apply to that. They just can't. And yet, there is that possibility sleeping in us which can respond to these words which stand for that which is beyond all specific, defined, limited concepts or thought. Now this is the aspect which lies sleeping in us, and it is this which comes to life as we live the religious life in the true sense, in the sense of that discipline which enables us to clean out of ourselves everything that hinders the fruition of the divine in us, embodied in us. So, this pure consciousness is our source, and it is embodied in us. It is important to bear in mind that it doesn't compel us in any way. God or the Absolute is non-compulsive. It's a very important point to bear in mind. It's non-compulsive. It doesn't compel. It is the absolute totality. If any manifestation of it during its limited lifetime does not quite fulfill its purpose, it doesn't matter at all to the totality, to the absolute. Because nothing is annihilated. The infinite, the totality, remains the totality. And therefore it is neither made more nor made less whether you or I succeed in fulfilling our divine destiny or not. This is where you can see the transcendent nature of that love and grace and wisdom and beauty which includes everything. What we call good or bad, successful or a failure, or anything you like. We function within the closed sphere of mortality. Transcendence is transcendence. Unimpeded, unhindered by our mortality, and yet the miracle of it. Our entire process, our whole realm of mortality, is completely held within that immortality. There are deep significances to this. You can feel them out yourselves and work them out. In our own day and age, there is the saying amongst certain cultures, the so-called advanced nations, all men are born free and equal. This is not true at all. We are not born free and equal. We as we are born in ignorance, in bondage, and in suffering. Freedom, true freedom, is of a transcendental nature. It isn't relative. It is not compulsive. It cannot be given. It cannot be taken away. It cannot be won or lost through any effort or through conflict. If only the human race, or at least the major part of it, could see this simple truth. Perhaps it is not so very simple as it sounds, but if a sufficient majority can see this simple truth, all the horror of human history, which is represented by the wars and the revolutions and everything for winning our freedom, as they call it, would disappear at all. You cannot fight. You cannot struggle for that which is infinite and absolute. Can you fight for space and possess it, bring it home and say, this is the space I won in the battle? Impossible. Can you buy a piece of space? Can you have a conference or a treaty to decide you have that space, I'll have this space, and so forth? It can't be. And it's the same with these transcendent values and the transcendent actual archetypal forces. Our task, therefore, is to let this spirit of freedom, which we do not know yet really, let it function freely through us by not hindering it. What we can see and know are all those aspects, those elements in our daily life, our thought, our behavior, and so on, which hinders that freedom and keeps us enslaved. In other words, let our consciousness, as it is at the moment, change in such a manner that it grows into and becomes completely one with pure or absolute consciousness. Now, one might be inclined to say, oh, but this is an impossible ideal for the millions. All right, never mind the millions. You and I are considering this matter together. Let us consider it in terms of ourselves. It may be impossible for many people. They have to decide whether they would like to try or not to try. You and I can decide here and now whether we are keen, whether we are prepared to give ourselves to realize this state. Let us now, quite briefly, mention the main elements of our present ignorance and bondage and suffering. At the outset, let me say, ignorance for us in this particular context does not mean that we don't know algebra or biology or history or something like that. It is not that ignorance we are concerned with. It is our ignorance of the inner realities which constitute our being, our life, and our actual activity in thought and feeling, in word and deed, which promotes the fulfillment of the purpose of our existence. Ignorance of all that. That is the real ignorance. Now, we are ignorant of the true nature of the world, the true nature, and of our environment. We are ignorant of the true nature because even the best of scientists, whatever they see, whatever they observe and record, is afterwards interpreted by minds which have their limitations, their conditioning, which they cannot escape. They don't look into that conditioning and try to become free of that conditioning, so that their vision of what they have seen and experienced is the truest possible vision. It is another model, as they say, as they quite rightly say, and scientists are beginning to recognize this today, is just a model of the universe, of the environment, or the particular situation in which people find themselves. It's only a model. It's like a photograph and not the reality. We are ignorant of the cosmic order and its laws. The whole cosmos exemplifies order, and this order is so astonishing in its actuality that our minds do not really grasp the orderliness of this order, because its order, as the transcendent mind can see it, but I haven't got a transcendent mind. I haven't arrived at that stage yet. And therefore, what I see is always somewhat distorted. It is not the final truth. If people saw this, they would cease saying, oh, ours is the one and the only truth, everything else is false. And you see all the misery and suffering that that leads to. They have only to realize that we do not know the cosmic order and its laws. We see only a fraction of it. We do not know the trends of life for mankind, and therefore we do not know the purpose of our own existence, the real purpose. We may spin out wonderful ideas and pictures out of a laid down theology or philosophy or some scientific observation, but they are all limited. The real trends of life go completely beyond our thinking and observing and feeling. But we can observe and feel and think in a manner which is at least in tune with the actual trends of life. And if we live according to that, then our understanding, our grasp of the knowledge of the trends of life would be a truer knowledge. Now, if that sort of growth takes place in our own minds with regard to the knowledge of the trends of life, then we are actually going forward, in the real sense of the word forward. We are moving towards the fruition of our existence. We are ignorant of our own true nature. How many people in the world really know themselves? They may go to a psychoanalyst, a psychiatrist. They may go to a person with a religious or spiritual reputation, to a guru, as they say in India. Guru is the word they use, you see. They may go to him. But supposing that psychologist or analyst or guru is himself not yet the perfected Holy One, that is to say, the man who has come to his full fruition, his perception of what you are will accordingly be limited. One man cannot help another man to a degree which goes beyond the limits of him who wants to help. You see, these are the difficulties. We do not know the meaning of the words man and human. They are two quite extraordinary words, and they are meaning in fullness. They are meaning in terms of our mortal existence and relationship to the immortal is something which escapes the majority of human beings in the world. They don't know the meaning of man. They don't know the meaning of human. Consider how many people really begin to understand the meaning of that verse in the first chapter of Genesis 26, verse 26. And Elohim, God the Supreme as the creative energy producing the whole cosmos, after having created this, that and the other, he says, let us make man, I would rather prefer to say, let us create man in our own living likeness. Now, just think of that. If we are created, or should be therefore, representatives of that creation, in the living likeness of Elohim himself, of God himself, then we would all be very, very different, wouldn't we? So do we really know ourselves? No. This is something which we have to discover. And because of that, we actually are not in the fully human state. The human state is the fully human state is the goal of the human species, the flowering of the human species. We are on the way to it. Therefore, our actual state, without insulting human beings, is a subhuman state. It's important to bear this in mind. If we really see this, we would have no conceit about ourselves. We'd be free of all pride, and we'd be free of measuring ourselves against each other in terms of superior and inferior. Think of the difference it would make to human society, to human well-being and happiness, if only people understood this and realized that every human being, whatever his qualities may be, whether he be an enemy or a friend, he is our fellow human being moving towards the supreme consummation of full humanity. So we begin to see how ignorant we are, really. Also, therefore, we do not know the potentialities which lie sleeping in us, hidden in us. And for the vast millions of the world, they only lie hidden throughout the lives of those people. They never come to fruition. They never even begin to move towards fruition. Now that is a sad thing, but we mustn't feel upset about it. If you or I feel upset about it, then our capacity to be of use or help to that man is that much less. Supposing you are a doctor, you have medical knowledge, and you see an accident in the street. Now, if you feel too upset about it, you'd be no good trying to help him. You have to be perfectly calm and cool and balanced. Then you can really help him on the spot. Otherwise you can't. It's like that in this sphere also. We do not know the right, the pure, and therefore happy use of all our senses and mind. And this is one of the very important points, practical points, concerning our life process and our development towards human fruition. We misuse our senses all the time. We are the slaves of our sense pleasures and the animal drives in us, which makes us mistake sensational delights and the wild pursuit of these delights for happiness. Happiness is the gift of God. Through nature, through our actual living being as such, we have only to let that happiness flood through us, well out of us, come to us from the world, instead of chasing delights which we spin out with our distorted ways of thinking and feeling. And the result is pain, sorrow, disappointment, illness, and general misery. If we only keep quiet and let the joy of the universal creative process flood through us, then we will use our senses rightly if we remain fully awake to all that and let it flow through us. But we are ignorant of all that. So we largely waste and misuse our life energies. How many people, when they come towards the end of their lives, they regret that from their youth onwards they didn't use their life energy, their health, their strength in the right way. They misused it. And therefore, in the end, it is dust and ashes. Thus, we are ignorant of the meaning of freedom. And because of that, we live in bondage to our environment, our physical environment, to our institutions, to the demands by the state and by society, to ideologies which are repressive and oppressive. This is not the whole story, admittedly. A good many things are right. And if a good many things were not right, the human race wouldn't survive at all. It would perish. It is because of the rightness of some of our institutions and laws and ways of life, coupled with the fact that this mysterious life energy is so powerful that we can't go against it with sufficient strength as to destroy the human race as such. Although nowadays we are afraid that if we misuse atomic energy, it is a possibility. We are in bondage to our socio-cultural heritage, which, of course, we know has its good points, but which also imposes upon us so many limitations, so many conventionalities, rigidities, that we cannot grow freely, we cannot progress at the right sort of speed. It's not wise to progress too fast. You know, it takes 40 years for an oak tree to mature. And then, because it takes the right time, it comes to its full strength and ripeness, healthily. And it's the same with us, it's the same with everything else. Nevertheless, our socio-cultural heritage imposes limitations. We are also in bondage to our conditioning by upbringing and education, in bondage to our heredity and our animal drives, which are the result of our natural evolution. Nature has developed the human being as one species out of all the other animal species. And therefore we inherit the natural drives for self-preservation and the preservation of the species, and fear and aggression and being on guard against danger and so forth. We inherit that from our original animal ancestry where the body is concerned. So we are in bondage to that. And we are also in bondage to our passion for self-gratification. We want our desires and our ambitions to be fulfilled. What happens? We are in conflict with our neighbors who have perhaps different desires and different ambitions and so forth. We are the slaves of our desires and appetites, our likes and our dislikes. And there are no real grounds for our likes and dislikes. We all have our aesthetic sense and our special tastes and so forth, which is quite right. But if we feel that ours should be expressed and our ambitions should succeed, even at the expense of another, then we are on the wrong track. We are in bondage to our fears, our hatreds, our delusions. We are the victims of our ambitions, our own as well as those of others. The victims of bodily defects and mental immaturity and fixation. We are prisoners of our misconceptions of ourselves. And that misconception of ourselves is most strongly expressed in the phrase, "I am I and not you." Now, of course, the living person, the body particularly, is that body, and not any other body. When we see people, if we touch them or hear them, we know that, oh, that person is so and so, that person is so and so. But we forget that every single person is wholly and completely related to every other single person. All mankind is one. In fact, not only all mankind, but the total universe is one. But because we are incapable of seeing and understanding and acting in accordance with the relationships between what appear to be separate people and things, we have all our troubles, therefore. There is enmity, there is discord, there is conflict. There is no true coordination and cooperation between the whole human race. The whole human race should be like an orchestra led by the divine conductor. Think how different the history of the human race and the story of our everyday life would be if you could only really see that. And so, we are the prisoners of our self-misconceptions and our dualistic mode of consciousness. Our consciousness is nowhere near approaching pure consciousness. It is the consciousness of separateness which divides all the time. And the functioning of our minds, our observation and so forth, is all in terms of analysis, in terms of splitting up and forgetting the relationships which make everything which appears to be separate one great living whole. the whole cosmos. So, inevitably, we are in the state of constant conflict and suffering, as indeed we have been through the ages. Now, do not think that this is a pessimistic picture. Not at all. We have to see the facts. And when we really see the fact as the fact, without being emotionally upset and say this is optimism, this is pessimism or something like that, then we can deal with it in the right way. Otherwise we can't. You have to see the fact as the whole fact, understand it, accept it, and then act as best as we can in relation to it. Now, it is easy enough, perhaps, for most of us here, surely, to see the truth of this in the worldly sense. The suffering in the world, natural disasters, volcanoes, earthquakes, floods, and so on, illness of the whole human race. Deprivation of food, warmth, and shelter for many millions of people in the world. Conflict within ourselves because of conscience, the voice of conscience. We want to do something, we do something, and conscience says, no, that is wrong, morally wrong. And so there is conflict inside, and there is pain and distress. There is mental confusion. We don't know what to do, we say. I wish I could see my way out of this, we say. And so forth. And we can't. And we are frightened. There is discord with the family. Discord with society. Discord when we break the law of the land. Discord in business. Strikes, revolutions, wars, the cruelty of man upon man, the cruelty of man upon the animal world, and so on. In fact, suffering is universal. Now, this is a fact which we must see quite clearly, and see it not only in terms of this is my suffering. See it as suffering. This is the fact of suffering. And if we can be free of just being concerned with it as my suffering, we shall become open-eyed and we shall see it as the suffering of all mankind. All human beings suffer something or other. And then there comes this growth of humaneness, of the feeling of compassion and pity for the suffering of all mankind. And that is a very great step forward. And so much of our self-centeredness, our selfishness, just naturally vanishes when we see that I am not the only one who is suffering. My neighbor is also in tears. But we have to see this. We have to be conscious of it. We are not conscious of this sufficiently. That's the trouble. Now, one can go on for a long time talking like that, but there is just one aspect in particular which we ought to emphasize today. There comes the point when people like yourselves, people like all of us, who are really sincere about human fruition and fulfillment and the living of the religious life, we really wake up to the fact that we are not in communion with the divine. We are not in communion with the cosmos as a whole, with the uttermost truth. We are not in communion. And when we see that intensely, that is the supreme suffering that we can undergo. But without that suffering, which acts as the supreme stimulus to see the truth, to devote all our energies and life to seeing the truth and to living the truth, without that suffering, we cannot change. That supreme change of consciousness, which ultimately takes us into the fruition and fulfillment of the purpose of our existence. When we see that, then for the first time, we begin to feel at home in our eternal home, which is pure consciousness, the source, the divine. We begin to feel at home in the cosmos as a whole, and we begin to feel at home in the little cosmos, the microcosm, which is our own living person.